This is unbelievable. College basketball. Incredible.
You know they're going to try to run backdoor play if they can get it. Under 10. Backdoor. Yeah! Out. Here's Davis. Davis for the win. He's got it! Princeton is going to the NCAA tournament.
One of the most enjoyable parts of being a coach at Princeton is the Faculty Fellows Program. The Fellows Program strengthens the ties between academic and athletic pursuits. Perhaps most importantly, it is an incredible resource for the student athletes and the coaches. My guest today is a professor of history at Princeton and a faculty fellow for the men's basketball program, Kevin Cruz. Kevin is currently teaching history at Princeton, a class called 1920 to 1974. He studies and teaches political, social, urban and suburban history of the 20th century. Kevin's done a little bit of everything. He's written books on white flight, Atlanta, and the making of modern conservatism. His new book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America, as well as several articles on modern conservatism. Kevin is thoughtful, insightful, and absolutely passionate about teaching. I sat down with him the other day to talk about becoming a professor, his research, writing his books, and just in general, his observations of being a faculty fellow at Princeton. I hope you'll enjoy. Kevin, you're from Nashville, Tennessee, and you had a very interesting life there. Can you walk me through it, please?
It was great. Nashville's a fantastic town. It's it was a little unusual. You know, we moved there when I was seven, so I just started to kind of make friends in school. And so I had that experience of being uprooted, but quickly took to Nashville as my home. I think of myself as a Southerner, maybe not born, but definitely raised. And Nashville is about as good a place for that as you can get. Great music, great food, great people. I could do without the heat and humidity in the summer. But other than that, I miss a lot about it.
Yeah. And so did you go into high school in Nashville?
That's right, yeah.
Which high school?
Went to a school called Montgomery Bell Academy. I was a scholarship kid there. It's a very kind of elite. It's not a boarding school, but it was, to give you a sense of where it stands, it was basically the inspiration for the movie Dead Poets Society. Uh-huh. It was a former student there wrote it about his English teacher. And we weren't, you know, again, weren't a northern boarding school, wasn't that elite, but that kind of all boys preparatory school attitude was definitely in effect.
Yeah, and so tell me about your family. Yeah, your siblings.
I've got two older sisters and a younger brother.
Okay,
and they're all in Nashville too.
Oh, they're still there.
Yeah.
Okay, and then so in high school, were you? It sounds like this school was, you know, a smaller school.
Yeah,
right. And so what were the influences on you there in terms of, that sort of took you eventually to North Carolina? Like, can you talk about, like,
sure,
when,
yeah,
like, were there the seeds planted for you by a particular teacher?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my favorite teacher there was not a history teacher. I had a couple decent ones. We also had some history teachers there who were the, kind of the football line coach who got thrown into a job because nobody else wanted it. But I had a couple great teachers there, and the best one was the art historian, Jim Womack, who he taught art and art history. But he was wickedly funny, but deadly serious about what he was doing. He had incredibly high standards. And I think now that I'm talking out loud here, but the more I think about it, I mean, that's probably a huge early influence on me in terms of my teaching style. Mm-hmm. I have really high standards for my students, but I also like to make the class a little fun, a little enjoyable.
Yeah, you've been nice to let me sit in on some of your lectures, and I've enjoyed in the mid sentence you telling somebody to turn their phone
right
off, which I really appreciate.
I'm easily distracted. I have the attention span of a squirrel, so I need to get that shut down easy.
If I could paint the picture for our listeners, you know, this, you're in Mekosh 50, which is one of the older Princeton classrooms, but the wood floors creak like your,
right,
you know, your grandparents' attic, and you know, there's no hiding.
Yep. Yep.
You walk into class late, and everybody knows you're,
yep,
you're
nobody
coming
can
in.
Sneak in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you know that, you know, if somebody at that school would have said, to point out who the next professor of history is going to be, would they have pointed to you?
Ooh. Yeah, maybe. I mean, it was always something I was interested in. It hadn't quite become a passion that really came in college. But yeah, it was something I was always kind of fascinated by.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, walk me through, you know, how a young guy from Nashville, Tennessee gets to North Carolina, University of North Carolina.
University of North Carolina. Well, I was looking for a, obviously a top rate program. And by this point, I kind of knew I wanted to be in history. I wasn't quite sold, but I knew I was looking at that. And we looked at a number of schools. And to my ever-loving embarrassment later, as a UNC grad, my top choice at the time was Duke. And so I visited, and Duke had it was a great school, impressive program. The problem is that my dad had declared bankruptcy in my junior year in high school. And so the thought of – I got into Duke, but the thought of paying the bills for Duke was a little ridiculous. It was at the time, I want to say – $25,000 a year, which now is maybe normal, but at the time was incredibly huge. And UNC was $10,000 a year and had a program that was actually rated better than Duke's, according to the rankings at the time. So it was an easy call. Mm-hmm. And one I was really happy with in retrospect. I don't think I would have thrived at Duke. I think given my background, given a lot of things, it wouldn't have been the fit I thought it was when mm-hmm. I was imagining it from afar.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's a...
Besides your natural Duke hatred that you built up over 4 years.
It's hard to look back before that Duke hatred. I think, I mean, when I visited, I found that the students were... everyone had, I remember, had a BMW, had a computer in their dorm room, could afford things like that. That wasn't quite where I was at. And I'm sure that's not an accurate picture of Duke, but that's the picture I got visiting.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I was going to... quite fit in there. Again, I'd gone to an expensive prep school, but I was a scholarship kid, and so it wasn't that my family was poor or anything. You know, I came from an upper middle class family, but not quite the level that I saw when I was at Duke.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, not to tell everybody your age, but we're about the same age, and you know, $10,000. The cost of going to school has really increased.
Sure.
Princeton's tuition has gone up quite a bit.
Right.
And so is tuition around the country. But $10,000 back then felt like a million, a lot of money to a family, especially when you have other siblings. And you're at North Carolina. Boy, you know, this is a hoops podcast.
Yeah.
But a little bit about myself, like I was an economics major here, but if I could do it all over again, I'd be a history major. In the history class that I've gone to, I've taken more notes in mm-hmm. your class than I did sometimes as an undergrad, which is another story. But it must have hurt a little bit that Duke won the national title in 91 and 92.
Brutal,
right. Okay. So, but you were on campus as a junior in 93?
Yep.
Okay. So, tell me about and I want to talk about academic influences at North Carolina, but tell me about that team real quick. So who was
– Well, I mean, the if you look back at the roster now, it's amazing they won a national championship. It doesn't seem like the kind of – especially given that they played against the Michigan Fab Five, right? But they were – you know, it was Eric Montross at center. You had George Lynch at forward. Those are the only two guys drafted off the team. Donald Williams was a great guard. Derek Phelps. Henrik Rodal is the other forward, I guess. And then a bunch of guys who just came off the bench. But it wasn't a team that – I mean, I think they were a number one seed in a tournament, but it was the team everyone immediately wrote off. There were a lot of even doubts why they were number one seed. And then in the Final Four, they made their way through Kansas and then Michigan, two incredible teams that year. And just everything fell their way.
Mm-hmm. What was the feeling like on campus, like being a student in a place like – and were you an avid college basketball fan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was insane. And I'd been to, I think the one game I'd been to that year, I can't remember who it was, but we'd won. And getting tickets into the game was difficult. You know, I had to kind of camp out at the Dean Dome and there was a lot of demand. And then the seats weren't that great. This is the one thing UNC did not do well. We were not, this is the one thing I'll give to Duke is they handled their student seats in the stadium in Cameron very well.
Yeah.
You know, they're right up front.
One small concession.
Yeah. We're you know, in the Dean Dome, we were way up at the backs. We had the nosebleed seats often. But watched every game religiously. And I mean, probably literally every game that season we watched. And for the Final Four, it was insane. The Kansas win was huge. Again, nobody thought we were going to win that game. And Franklin Street just erupted. Mm.
Where was the game played? Do you remember the Final Four weekend?
I want to say Indianapolis. Mm. That might just be because it always seems like it's there. Yeah,
it always seems like it's there, right? What was so Franklin Street erupted? What, like, you know, what was that like?
Just hordes of people. It must have been 10,000 on the street on that first one, and then the on the championship game, it was insane. I think it was something like 25,000 people kind of rushing the street, and I mean rushing. We were at a bar back at the top of Franklin Street that you, where we when you came out on the hill, you could see all the way down, and it was as if every single bar and restaurant along Franklin Street opened up, and it was just hordes kind of pushing. It looked like a zombie film where just kind of masses rushed out into the streets. And it was just chaos.
Yeah.
And it went, you know, some ugly points. I remember seeing some guys trying to flip a car.
Oh, yeah.
See people trying to break down a tree. But it was
that
mostly
seems
just,
to happen with
a, yeah, it does. It does. I've never understood the let's destroy our own world part. but it was just chaos. You know, tens of thousands of people in the street, kind of mostly drunk. But largely well behaved, but just in the best mood ever. It was amazing.
Yeah, I always sports can be a great unifier for a campus, and you know, as you know, you get a little further along, you know, people tend to like really start to pay attention. When we played in the NCAA tournament in 1996, we played UCLA, beat them in the first round, and
yeah, I
had some
that.
Friends that were here that talked about you know that night here on campus, you know. You've mentioned Bill Luchtenberg.
Yeah.
Tell me about him and how he influenced you while you were at North Carolina.
Yeah. So Bill Luchtenberg is one of the greatest 20th century historians. He was the if you've ever gone to Washington D.C. to see the FDR Memorial there, he's the guy who picked out the quotes. He's the go to man for this. The book he wrote on the New Deal in the 60s still holds up. It's beautifully done. But he had been at Columbia for forever. And had been brought down to UNC basically to finish out his career for the last – I don't remember how many years he spent there, but it coincided with when I was there. And it was really lucky for me that he did. This was back when North Carolina really invested heavily in its higher education, and places like UNC had the money to do this, to bring in top talent. Things have changed, and you wouldn't find that today. But I was lucky at that time that they were still doing that. And so he was amazing. He taught a course on basically the courses that I started here. His was U.S. since 1933. Mine was U.S. since 1920. That's just what I inherited. But he was amazing. He would give these lectures that were perfect. I mean, in every way. These crisply formed arguments, amazing anecdotes, sometimes his own personal anecdotes sprinkled in. Again, he had...
So how old was he at the time?
He was...
Everyone seems old when you're in college.
Yeah. Right? I want to say he was probably in his mid-60s at the time. Yeah. But he had... So he'd been a teenager during the New Deal. So he would tell us about, you know, how he made ends meet. You know, I lectured on the National Youth Administration the other day in class. When he did, he talked about how he had a job there and he, you know, he made some money through a job there and he made some money selling ice cream at an FDR speech. And that's how he got to college, was he scraped together cash here and there. But then he became a really prominent presidential historian. So he became part of history at a high level. You know, I remember he was telling a story one day about how he'd literally bumped into Gerald Ford at this event, or he was talking with, you know, he was always talking with the network news folks. He used to appear on, I think, NBC. National News as kind of their in-house historian. But he always kept his priorities right. Even that late stage of his career, even that high profile that he was, he always put his students first. And so I remember as a sophomore in his class coming to office hours to ask a question, and he hurried this guy off the phone because, oh, I've got a student here. I've got to go. Didn't make me
wait. That made a really big impact on you.
And the person he hurried off the phone was Dan Rather. And so so this sophomore in his class was more important than this network news anchor who needed some input.
So he's not only intellectually an influence, a lecturing influence, sort of the way he patterned himself, but, you know, as a person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is he still?
He's still alive, yeah.
Do you still talk to him?
I last exchanged letters. He still writes letters by typewriter, and I've got them. They're fantastic. But I last exchanged notes with him about a year or two ago. He's still alive. He's getting very much up there in years. He's got to be in his let me do the math. He's got to be in his late 80s by now.
I imagine he's proud of the work you're doing.
Well, I'm one of many, many students he's had. I mean, again, his graduate students that he had at Columbia alone basically populated the profession. And so I'm kind of like in fact, my advisor at Cornell was one of his former students. So he wasn't just kind of my undergrad advisor. He was my – kind of like my grandfather through my graduate advisor.
I'm curious, so, you know, because I just haven't had this conversation that often. You know, the coaching world tends to be very insular. Mm-hmm. I would imagine the path to being a college professor has some, you know, there's some similarities, you know, with a lot of people's paths. But when did you know that, okay, I really would like to pursue this and beyond being an undergrad, mm-hmm. this is something I'm passionate about and I'm when did you know? Was it this moment of the connection with the professor?
Mm-hmm. I think that was the seed of it, and it really came into focus. I think probably my junior year, as I got more into coursework, but really my senior year, and that was when I did a senior thesis with Luckenberg as my advisor.
Do you remember what that was on?
Yeah, it was a horrible topic, and looking back now, I'm embarrassed by it. It was. North Carolinian reaction to Truman's civil rights program of 1947-1948. Mm. And the X reaction to Y is the most simple and obvious form of any kind of historical paper. But I got to do primary research with it. I got to write with Luckenberg because I'd always known that I wanted to teach. Mm-hmm. And going in, I thought maybe I'll be a high school teacher. I don't know. My father who's an accountant and was a very practical man, said, all right, if you want to follow your passion to teaching, you can, but let's find a way that'll be a little more stable. So he suggested think about becoming a professor, mm-hmm. Which had seemed so far out of my reach at the time. But with his encouragement and the encouragement of some profs, Luckenberg including them, I thought about it. And so the senior thesis was really the moment where I finally got to do what historians do. I did the research. I did the writing. And I'd always been worried that part of it was something I wouldn't like as much as I thought I would like teaching. But I quickly realized I had a passion for it. And over time, improved at it and really liked doing it. So once I realized that I liked both the teaching and research part of the job, I really knew what I wanted. And so I was able to I didn't take time off, as a lot of people do, between undergrad and grad. I went straight into Cornell.
Yeah. So you're talking about a lot of things that I do want to talk about. But let's go ahead and – so you arrive at Cornell where you got – that's where you ended up getting your PhD. Yep. And this might seem like I'm passing through a lot, but, you know, writing a dissertation it's a mammoth operation. And one of the people that we're very close with in our program, Dov Grossgall, when I first arrived here, he was in the middle of that process. Talk about the days, you now also teach graduate level, mm-hmm. you know, so you're mentoring these students of yours. Talk about your dissertation days, the people you met, the research mm-hmm. you did.
Yeah, so my dissertation was what became my first book, and so the book is called White Flight, Atlanta and the Making of Modern Conservatism, and it was basically a study of segregationist. In a single city, to kind of get a sense of not to sympathize with them, but to empathize, and that's an important difference that historians have. Sympathy means we express a common feeling with and a common attitude with somebody. Empathy is just your feelings aside, try to understand how someone understood themselves. And so, I'd always been fascinated by the civil rights movement. This is something that had really caught fire with me as an undergrad. UNC had not just a great history program, but a great African-American studies program. And I took courses there too with a couple of great people. And this really quickly became my passion. But as a white Southerner, I would read these stories about the civil rights movement and I didn't recognize the white people in them because the white people in the civil rights stories were either these kind of crusading liberals who stuck their neck out and did all kinds of amazing good. They read like a hero of a Hollywood movie, or they were the villain. They were Bull Connor or George Wallace. They were the Klansmen. And yes, those people existed, but there was a vast swath of white Southerners in between who, whatever their sympathies for segregation, weren't quite as far gone as Connor was. So I wanted to kind of recover that history. And
how do you conceive – so – Was it the intention to start doing research and this would eventually become a book?
Mm-hmm.
And how did you pick the subject?
Yeah. I picked the subject almost by – not by chance, but I came to it really late. Originally, I was going to study one of the parts of kind of the mainstream civil rights movement story, that Montgomery to Memphis story people tell about Martin Luther King. And I was going to focus in on the one place where he stumbled. There's a campaign he has in Southwest Georgia, in Albany, Georgia, where he doesn't get anything. And he doesn't succeed there because the local sheriff isn't Bull Connor. He's a man named Laurie Pritchett who teaches his men that the way in which the civil rights movement succeeds is we lock them up. We overreact. We beat them. That gets press attention here. That gets national outrage. So the way to handle these demonstrators is to smother them with kindness. So be polite. Be civil. If we have to arrest anybody, we're not going to fill up our jails. We're going to send people out to surrounding county jails. We're going to maintain order here locally. And it works. The Albany movement is the failure of the early civil rights movement. And King has to rebound and go to Birmingham, where he finds someone who will overreact. He goes to Selma, where he finds Jim Clark, who will overreact, and he finds someone who won't follow this script smartly. So at first I thought, that's what I want to look at. I want to look at where white Southerners, segregationists, figured out how to stop the civil rights movement and why that wasn't followed elsewhere. The problem was, the more I looked at that, and literally the day before my general's exams as a grad student, like I'm gearing up for the big test as a graduate student.
Just explain what the general's exams are.
You sit in a room with your advisor and at least two other faculty members who basically quiz you on everything.
And this is it, right? I mean, this has to go well.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't get this, you don't advance to candidacy. You don't move on to write the dissertation. This is a huge moment. It's the academic version of hazing, really. But the day before that, when I had this dissertation plan all planned out, I thought. And it had been brewing for a while, but I finally thought, I don't want to write this. It'll be a little bit different, but it's going to be just like another study we have. And practically speaking, I don't know if I want to live, honestly, for 2 years in Southwest Georgia where I don't know anybody. It wasn't really appealing to me on a personal level as well as professionally. So I thought, well, I still want to look at this thing, but I want to look someplace different. And I'd just come across some work that had been done on Detroit and race relations there by a guy who's a friend of mine now, Tom Segrue. But this came out – I read this article in the Journal of American History like a week before Generals and was kind of floored by it. You can look in cities and find this stuff. I hadn't thought about that before. Mm. I hadn't been trained as an urban historian before. But what he'd found in this environment was so amazing and so spectacular. Not just – we knew it was there, but he used this set of – sources. The beautiful part about doing a study of a city like that, especially a city like Atlanta, is you've got political leaders there who are asking these questions. And it's in a moment where people aren't hiding their answers yet. And so what I found out, this answer is about getting into the research part of it. What I found out as I dug into this stuff and what made me convinced that Atlanta was the right place to do this was that it was this moment where they were asking questions openly and people were answering them openly. So the city would send out questionnaires, I found, to neighborhoods that were transitioning from white to black in terms of home purchases. And they asked people, black buyers are moving into your neighborhood. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to move out? Are you going to put up a fight? How do you feel about this?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a level of reaction at kind of a micro level that I've never seen this before in another book. So I found in Atlanta countless documents like that where they were keeping track of that. The city government, local civil rights groups, but also of kind of a vocal contingent of segregationists.
Yeah.
And so I used that as a way in to try to answer this question of, so what did ordinary white people feel about the civil rights movement? How did that change them? How did they react to that? How did they recoil from that?
This has been a little bit of a theme in a lot of your work, but it's also a theme at the time, right? Like, and this is borrowing from some of your own words, but even with desegregated schools in Atlanta, the fight against the rights of others. Like it can be couched in some really right. interesting ways.
Right.
Well, yes, you can move in, but we want you here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the way we choose to think about it and to say it, right? Like so.
Right. Nobody likes to think of themselves as the bad guy.
Yeah.
Everyone is their own protagonist, right? And that's something that, again, I think we as historians always have to remember. It's not whether I like or dislike somebody. I need to understand how they understand themselves. And so these segregationists, they never saw themselves as suppressing the civil rights of others. They would always put scare quotes, so-called civil rights. They firmly believed they were defending the rights of people like them and the right to have private property and do what you want with it. I can sell it to a white. I can sell it to a black. I can refuse service to this customer at my restaurant. That's my right as a businessman. I have a right to determine who goes to school with my kids. I have a right to keep people out of my neighborhood. It's a set of kind of defensive and maybe negative rights, but they thought of themselves as rights all the same.
You know, at the time you met your wife in Ithaca.
Yep.
And you have a young family, but like this is very involved work, right? Yeah. Like you're gone a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so how do you, but this is, you know, sort of the beginnings of, you know, sort of, you know, getting a book out there, right? Yeah. Like this is it, right?
Yep.
So it's a, could you walk me through that?
Yeah, sure. So with the first one, I was lucky in that, my now wife and I were simply dating at the time. So she was working in New York. I was in Atlanta. We would see each other once a month.
Hmm.
You know, a weekend I would fly up or she would fly down. Luckily, Atlanta to New York was a pretty easy. We racked up Delta miles and I think. But that was basically it. And then my life for 2 years in Atlanta, and I spent a year on the ground doing research and a year writing. And my life was the dissertation. And it can be you have to have, I think, the personality type where you can survive that because it can be incredibly isolating. I had a week one time where I remember the only person I spoke to face to face was the security guard at the library and the person at the front desk in the archives. Mm-hmm. And that was it because it was, you know, I would get up. I would work from 8:30 to 5, whatever they were open. And then I would go home,
take everything and do this.
Go for a run. I would eat dinner at home, write up my notes, go to bed, wash, rinse, repeat. And that was life for 2 years.
Mm.
And it's solitary and it's it can drive you a little batty if you're not careful. I had some friends in Atlanta that would pull me out of the archives and we'd go out and you know, hang out on the weekends or go to Braves games or whatever. But a lot of it was just kind of solitary plugging away.
I had John McPhee and he was describing and I'll try to make this – I can't make it sound nearly as good as he did, but the structure of a book. And he was like, I was fascinated with this idea of having a subject here, A, and then A1 sort of connected, and then there's B, and there's A1's connected a little bit more strongly to B, and then so on. And he was sort of explaining how this long process mm-hmm. works, and he teaches a seminar here. And he was like, but that's all boring to me now. I just tell my students, you do it. Which I thought was great. And I was like, yeah, that sounds impossible. I mean, like, and what you're describing is what people have to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And
a lot of it is finding your own way. I mean, because as there are certain things that we can guide them in terms of research tips or writing tips, but a lot of these things are kind of personal preferences. Yeah. So, you know, I have a wide variety of students who have a wide variety of approaches. Some are night owls who stay up all night writing. Others have a kind of a strict 9-to-5 schedule. Some research a chapter and then write it. Some do all the research and then all the writing. Yeah. There are different approaches here. You've got to kind of just find what works for you because ultimately you're the only one doing it.
Yeah. So you're now at Princeton. You're teaching and you've taught a number of different undergraduate classes. And just backing up a little bit, one of the best parts about you know, being a student at Princeton and speaking from experience is the relationship you can have with professors like mm-hmm. yourself. I would imagine that knowing your relationship with Bill Luckenberg, like this is what drew you here as well.
Yeah.
But I guess my broad question is, you mentioned you inherited a class 1920 to present. I think I took the same class, not
sure.
from
yep.
you,
yep.
when I was a student here. You know, maybe not all the work you've done, but like, why the 20th century and not a different era for you? Obviously,
yeah,
that's your period. And then if a second part to that is what's talk to me about teaching a big class in Mikosh 50 at Princeton.
Yeah. Why 20th century? I think for me and colleagues that work on different eras and different periods will and different places will obviously have different answers. But for me, the allure of history was helping me understand my present, and so the past really has prologue, and so everything that's animated my own research has been trying to understand something around me. So again, that first book was trying to understand what white Southerners, like the ones I'd known all my life, how they had been impacted by the civil rights movement and how it had changed them and their politics. And then this last book I did was about something that came about. The inspiration was in the early 2000s, and it was as the religious right was kind of surging again.
This is Under the Nation of God.
Yeah. One Nation Under God.
One Nation, excuse me.
And as I was trying to figure out, the strength of the religious right. So I figured out part of the kind of the racial element of our politics. I wanted to get my hands on the religious side. And that's generally just held true with everything I read about or teach about or definitely write about, is it stemmed from a desire to try to explain, if only to myself, but hopefully a lot of other people, to explain things about the present day situation and to figure out how we got where we are today.
Well, that's you're skipping ahead, but I don't mind going there. So have you ever seen anything like the current climate in our history?
Bits and pieces. I mean, we've seen this kind of raw edged populism before from people like Huey Long or Charles Coughlin. Certainly has the anti-Semitic angles that we're seeing this week. We've seen the kind of almost white nationalist populism in someone like George Wallace before. We've seen
George Wallace in the early 60s.
Yep. Yeah. In 63, becomes governor of Alabama, and then has two.
He was really a third party candidate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he ran both as a Democrat in 64 and 72, but his real run came in 68.
Yeah. I'm trying to show off.
Yeah, that's good. That's
I know
good.
A little.
That's good. No, you do. Yeah. But so in 68, he runs an independent candidacy. And Wallace is the one I go back to time and time again, because Wallace is a lot like Trump. In that he is, I think, willing to play with some once taboo topics in American politics that I think since Wallace we thought had largely been at least papered over a little bit, and not quite as explicit, but kind of touching into this kind of base of working class white resentment and at its fringes more of a kind of an explicit white nationalism. And Wallace did that. But like Trump, Wallace never really seemed to care about that issue. It was an issue for him to exploit. Wallace, there's a great quote, there's a great biography by Dan Carter called The Politics of Rage on Wallace. And in it, he talks to a guy who says, Wallace didn't believe in anything. He just did what he ever had to do to get votes. If you parachuted George Wallace into Albania, within a week he'd be the head of the local communist circle. within a month he'd be the head of the party, and within a year he'd be at the Soviet Comintern. He could believe whatever he wanted to believe to do this, and I get that vibe with Trump a little bit. He's got sort of a flexibility, but the politics are a lot the same, because not only reaching out to kind of disaffected whites, but doing so in a way that doesn't fit with modern conservatism either, because he's not angry about big government. He's not angry about the welfare state. He just wants, like Wallace did, wants to make sure that the beneficiaries are his supporters.
Mm-hmm.
But the style is a lot like George Wallace too, which is kind of amazing. If you watch and you'll see later in class, I'll show clips of Wallace's speeches. They're a lot like Trump.
Mm.
They're this mix of kind of sinister threats, but also kind of a lighthearted clowning. And the way in which he deals with protesters at his rallies is exactly like Wallace, calling them out, using them as a symbol of everything that he and his fans hate. And it becomes this kind of visceral, tangible marker of everything they're fighting against, and a sign that Trump, like Wallace, will fight for them and fight against these protesters. So, a lot of echoes of that. That said, we are so far off the rails from what we've seen before.
Well, we haven't really seen a presidential candidate use Twitter to right. the effect, you know, really like right. I hesitate. Just his ability to capture a moment, mm-hmm. 140 characters, right?
Like, right.
And appeal to his constituency. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the current class you're teaching 1920 to 1974. You know, I'm sure you'll get in the at Princeton you have two lectures and then a small precept, a right. smaller group discussion. I'm sure in those discussions, it's kind of. These things have to go that yeah. direction, right? Yeah.
But it's tough because, you know, in the classroom, I want to make sure, obviously, that every student's beliefs and political opinions.
Sure.
I'm not trying to dictate to anyone in the classroom. And the danger then comes that, and we'll see it every week we go on in this class as it gets more and more up to the present, is that they naturally want to connect it to current events. And I do that all the time myself, and I get that. But we constantly have to remind them, that, you know, we're here to talk about the material in front of us today. So you may be inspired by current events, but let's really focus right. on the text in front of us. And part of that is obviously a way to make sure that students are actually doing the reading and not just kind of riffing on what they saw in the news last night, but also to make sure everyone knows that this is a space where all ideas are valid, that we can talk about anything and everything, and there's no one right interpretation yeah. of these things.
One of the real benefits for me, you know, being a coach here, is a couple of my current players are in your class. And I've been able that day as they come down to the gym to say, what'd you think? You know, and then one of them was like, well, what'd you think? You know, and it's been really powerful. It's opened some really great doors for me. And one of the things that I love about, you know, being here with you today is hopefully you know, when I started doing these conversations, you know, it was really kind of an excuse to get somebody sit down with somebody like you to show that, you know, not only are you you're a huge Kansas City Chiefs fan, you're a North Carolina alum, you were there for a national championship, but you're, you know, like, this is the point, right? Like, we want to have these conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about your bio is incredible. You know, you're an invited lecturer. You've been everywhere to give talks, mm-hmm. Richmond, Atlanta, University of Michigan, Oxford, Cambridge.
Yeah.
You're teaching in Mekosh 50, which for, you know, non-Princetonians is, you know, one of our best and most, you know, sort of hallowed lecture halls. Mm-hmm. What's it like to go away from Princeton as a Princeton professor and speak, to a group and, you know, what's your preparation like for that?
Yeah. It varies, you know, so I've talked to it's a variety of different environments. So everything from, you know, more often than not, if I go to a university, it'll be a small seminar room and it's like what I would expect to if I'm given a paper here. And so that's not that much different. I can kind of get a sense of what the audience will be interested in, what the level of questions will be. It'll be a very familiar environment. There are times where those kind of settings can be really great.
How are they great?
Well, I gave a talk at Cambridge. It was the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. This was when I was a junior faculty member. And it was at Clare College in Cambridge, which was just gorgeous. And I'm sitting in this ancient old seminar room with this giant table, and I'm in a chair that looks like it's from Dracula or something. It's this kind of high-backed, ornately carved wooden chair. It felt like I was on the throne. Like I literally turned to my host and was like, am I supposed to sit here? So it's like, yes, it is. But so I gave this talk, but it's late May 2004, and they've got the windows open, and it's unbearably hot outside. And I suffer from a Marco Rubio syndrome where I get easily dehydrated. especially when I talk. And so it was an incredibly hot room and I'm talking for 45 minutes, giving a talk based on white flight. And in front of me is about a shot glass worth of water. That's all they've given me. And so I am through that within 10 minutes and I'm just parched by the end. And what they do in England, or at least what they do at Cambridge, is at the seminar break, usually, you know, what we would do here is you would speak for 45 minutes and you'd have 45 minutes of question and answer, and then we're done and we go have refreshments downstairs. And at Cambridge, at least, you spoke for 45 minutes, then they break out the wine for the Q&A. So I am incredibly parched and a big glass of white wine comes down in front of me, and I must have knocked it back probably in one fluid motion just because I was desperate to get some liquid in my mouth. And when I realized, wait, this is a horrible idea, I'm still on the clock. I've got 45 minutes of Q&A from an incredibly smart room, because it wasn't just the Cambridge folks who were there. It was also – this is the kind of the keynote for a big conference. So a lot of other big figures – and again, I'm junior faculty. A lot of other big figures in civil rights history were there for this thing too. So that was an unusual space. But more often than not, again, it still follows that kind of seminar vibe. What's more unusual is now, especially with this last book, I've been given a lot of more public lectures. So I was out at Town Hall in Seattle and gave a talk to a few hundred folks there. Or I did one here at the Jewish Center for about 500 people. And it's different to get an audience who is predominantly, however well-informed they are, they're not academics. And so they're not interested really in, say, the interventions you've made in a certain literature, the kind of the different analytical frameworks, the arguments you've made. It's more about the basic history. So it's a different kind of talk. It's tell me about this, tell me about that.
More personal.
More personal, yeah. And it's much more of a kind of a narrative style, right? And so it's more of presenting the story in a way that will hopefully pique their interest in the topic. You know, the press would hope that they buy the book. I just hope that they get thinking about these things. But that's always radically different, because then I never know what's coming in the Q&A. When I present from anything I've done, when I present at a set of seminars, I can generally think of what the 10 or 12 questions I'm going to get.
Yeah.
And they always come up in some form or another. And so, which is great, because after a few of these, I've basically workshopped my answers and I'm good to go. The public events, though, they come from all over. And so, you know, you got, you know.
Anything that stands out?
Why do we have the Federal Reserve System when it's so clearly illegal? I'm not an expert on that. I didn't talk about that. I don't know.
Let me grab my colleague.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What? So Sundays, right? So you teach Mondays and Wednesdays. Generally, 2 days a week, you're teaching undergraduate classes.
Yep.
You're preparing your week. You're with your family, and then the Chiefs are on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you? So are you there in front, glued, beginning to end, and go back and why the Chiefs?
Okay, why the Chiefs is an easy one, because I was born in Kansas City, Shawnee Mission, Kansas, exactly. But we grew up in the suburbs of Kansas City. And my family on both sides goes back deep in Kansas. Both my grandpas were wheat farmers. Well, one of them farmed wheat and corn and Milo, but both farmers. And so Kansas was something that's been in my roots forever. And when we moved to Nashville, again, this was 1979. So, you know, no Titans there. There's still the Houston Oilers. Yep. So there's no local football team. So I maintained that old tie.
Mm-hmm.
And again, at seven, my tie wasn't that deep.
Right. This is the great thing about sports, right? We all have a tie somewhere.
Right. But I grown up with, you know, Chiefs hats and helmets and things like that. And just kind of, I think I imprinted. But it was really in the 80s that I started really becoming a fan for real. Kind of the Christian Okoye and the Nigerian Nightmare years.
Did you ever play Tecmo Bowl with
Okoye? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He was unstoppable
absolutely.
In that game.
Yeah. You know, which was good because, you know, again, as a Chiefs fan, I couldn't play. I was one of the few people who refused to play the Raiders. I couldn't be Bo Jackson because that was blasphemy.
Well, it was the 85 Bears era and Bo Jackson.
Yep. Yeah. So fell in love with the team then, I mean, on my own, and then followed them throughout the early 90s.
Joe Montana's arrival.
Joe Montana, Marcus Allen.
Very close, like AFC champions.
Yep.
Close to being AFC champion.
Yep. Choked it away twice. Those were not fun games to watch. But love the team, especially the defense. I was a huge fan of all our linebackers then. We had a great squad.
Was it Derek Thomas?
Thomas. Yep. Derek Thomas is my all-time favorite player.
Okay.
Number 58. Tragically taken too soon. Died in a car accident in 2000, I think. But him, we had great corners, just a fun team to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And had a moment there where it all seemed to be coming together, but it consistently fell short. I was saved in grad school by the fact that one of my roommates was a diehard Bills fan. So I had someone who had suffered even more than I had, and that took the edge off.
Did you see this 30 for 30 on the Bills, this four falls?
Yeah.
I don't know if you're getting the name right, but it's really powerful. It's almost like you don't want to watch it. At the end, it's the smiling faces of all these guys and how they're great people and they're doing a lot for the communities. Yep. It got me. I was emotional after watching it. Talking about the NFL, I wondered if you'd want to – what would be your take, on Colin Kaepernick? Currently we've got, during the national anthem, we've got professional athletes now kneeling. And this is now become a part of our conversation, right? This is a big deal for us.
Yeah. It's a significant moment. And I think we need to remember that there is a history behind this. This isn't something that that Kaepernick came up with on his own. There's some famous predecessors to this. Most famously, the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. Carlos and John raising their fists, even with the support from that Australian runner who had the silver, wearing a little badge. That's an iconic moment, and they did so too the national anthem. But we forget that a lot of athletes have felt this way, a lot of black athletes have felt this way, and not just ones that you might think of as kind of radicals like those guys in 68 with a black power salute. Jackie Robinson, in the early 70s, in a book he wrote, said, "I can't stand up and pledge allegiance to the flag. I can't sing the national anthem because I'm reminded of the uneven treatment that African Americans have at this time." This is a man who's a prominent African American leader, but a Republican. Hmm. I mean, he broke him with his party over some issues, but this is a fairly conservative guy and someone held up as kind of the model of integration and success. Even he bucked that.
What are the – when you hear your students or people talking about this issue, what do you hear people talking about and where do you disagree?
Well, I think what I've heard is and I understand this argument that the lack of what's perceived as a lack of respect for the anthem is taken as a lack of respect for the military abroad. And I don't think that's the intent of the protest. I think they've been very clear that this isn't about the American military, which we should note is one of the most successful integrated meritocracies in the world. If you want to look for a model for equality, I think the military has actually done a fairly good job on a lot of fronts, especially race. But rather that they're protesting excesses at home. Particularly in terms of police brutality and mass incarceration. And I don't think you can look at what's going on the ground now without thinking that there's truly a point there, that what we've seen is by no means nothing new, but through the use of cell phone videos and mass media, mass social media, we're seeing a lot of this stuff that I think a lot of people – outside of African American communities had not seen before, and so it's hard to turn a blind eye to it. And so all these protests are calling attention to that. I've heard people say, "Well, he doesn't have it bad. Why is he protesting? He's a star." Well, I don't think that level of fame, and there are a number of African American leaders you could talk to about this. Fame and success doesn't shield you from these realities out there on the street. And at the same time, if someone of that prominence won't take a stand, who will? You know, that's, I think, what is needed is for people who are relatively safe and secure to take a stand. That's how change happens. It's important to have kind of a mass base of support, but you need someone signaling from a position of, if not power, at least privilege, but they're with you, but they hear you, and that they're going to amplify your protests. And that's what Kaepernick has done. And it was really kind of baffling that we had people were upset with his silent protest, and then you've got other protests that turn uglier and more violent, and the response then is, "Well, why didn't you have a peaceful protest?" Well, we saw the reaction to the peaceful protest. Yeah. So I think it's important to remember that there are lots of ways of doing this, and even if people find what he's doing distasteful, this is the I think in some ways both the safest and the most effective way to get this message across. Yeah. So I think it's time to listen up.
Yeah. You mentioned the service, and it sort of segues into a thought that I had. I would love to, you know, sort of get your thought on this. So this year we're playing a game in Hawaii in Pearl Harbor. It's a really cool thing. So we're playing it's a 2-day game. So we play on December 6th and December 7th. Wow. So we're playing on the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Games on Fox Sports. And we're playing in this gym called Block Gymnasium, B-L-O-C-H. Rear Admiral Block at the time was the, I believe he was like the commander of the 14th Naval District of Hawaii. And he was the guy that's on the phone with the chief of naval operations, who's then on the phone with Roosevelt, saying, we're getting bombed right now. And then here's another wave of planes coming. And it sounds like, you know, sort of, you know, like a machine, like a drum beat, like just bullet holes everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's bullet holes in the side of this gym that we're playing in.
Wow.
It's a 4,000 seat gym. So we're playing in this game, and you teach a class, if I can parallel this, you know, 1974 to present. And you do talk about September 11th, which for our, you know, the current generation, a lot of the kids I'm recruiting are born in 1999,
right,
which is crazy. But, your students are aware of September 11th. Yeah. And for this generation that we're talking about 75 years ago, this was their September 11th. This was a seminal event. You know what? You're addressing my team on the eve of the game. Mm-hmm. What would be your words to them? Yeah, that's a tough one.
But, yeah.
How would you draw this sort of like moment that we're going to have?
Well, I think you've set it up really well. I think it is that earlier generation's 9/11. In fact, when 9/11 happened, we talked about it as our generation's Pearl Harbor. I mean, that's the touchstone, and the numbers are close. You know, in Pearl Harbor, you've got about, if I'm remembering right, about 2,500 dead, massive numbers of planes and ships killed or sunk, like 150 out of 183 planes, if I'm remembering right, 5 out of 6 battleships. Mm-hmm.
You've got the USS Arizona, which is still there. And, you know, it's sort of a graveyard.
A graveyard, right.
It really is a ceremonial place. Mm-hmm.
But it's just such a shock and such a blow. I think it pierces the American belief that had already been decaying, I think, with the bombing of London, but it really pierced this sense that America could be protected from all this, that America could shut out the war. You know, we talked about the election today, and Trump has revived the slogan of America First. Well, that was a slogan of isolationists before World War II. And the America First movement was started right here at Princeton by Princeton undergrads. It gets bankrolled by the heads of places like Quaker Oats and other conservative businessmen. But it gets started right here, and it becomes this major national movement of trying to keep America out of the war. This is a European war. We don't have anything to do with this. We shouldn't be involved. Charles Lindbergh is kind of the spokesman for this, insists there's no way that America can defeat the Nazi war machine. We should stay out. Now, that feeling of isolationism had slowly been chipped away as Hitler marched through Europe, and with the fall of France and with Britain basically being the lone holdout, suddenly Americans are starting to realize that isolationism can't work, that it's about to be the U.S. versus the world. So what Pearl Harbor does, even though it wasn't connected with the kind of the building European war that they were focused on, is it shakes America out of that sense of complacency, that sense of isolation, that sense of lack of connectedness to the rest of the world and the crisis that's going on. And in a lot of ways, that's what 9/11 did.
Yeah.
It really made Americans realize that there had been acts of terrorism here before, including that one in 93 at the World Trade Center, but nothing on this scale, nothing of this magnitude.
No, right? Like Churchill had a famous quote saying, like, you know, almost like, whew.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. He called up FDR and said, well, this simplifies things.
Yes, you know? Yeah. All right. You know, you get to interact with our team. You know, you've come to a few practices. What's your take on what's it like to be a student athlete here at Princeton? You know, you've seen it now as an undergrad. You've seen it at Cornell. You're here at Princeton. You have student athletes in your classes. Mm-hmm. What's your impression?
My impression is that they are truly student athletes, and it's really a delight to see. A lot of them, you know, a few lucky few will, you know, be able to go pro and make a career of this in some form or another, maybe in coaching, maybe in training. But for most of them, their time here as an athlete is really been their point of entry into being a student. And so they've used this, and I think beautifully well. And some of my best students have been student athletes. And I think it's because, A, they know what they've got here. They know what it takes to get into a place like this. B, no one has the work ethic of a student athlete because they have to.
Yeah, I love that you say that. I mean, we really talk about this all the time. I mean, you've got to have your ducks in a row.
They do. When I make an appointment with a student athlete, they're on time. Because they've got to be on time because they've got something after that. Mm-hmm. But they respect my time. They come prepared. They come with good questions. They're almost always attentive in class. They are soaking every last drop out of this experience, both on the field in practice, but in the classroom too. And they've got a sense of drive that's really clear. But again, the work ethic is something that's always impressed me. Mm. And it's not just, you know, what you would see from students and what you might think of. I don't want to insult a sport here. I'm not going to name one, but the flagship sports, right? Basketball players, football players, players in kind of the major sports you would think of here that have maybe the high profile that are going to be on Fox Sports. They've got that same drive too. They don't have that attitude of, well, we're a level above. They are really making the most of this. So I see basketball players. Again, this is they've got to remember, they stand out in a lecture hall.
Yeah.
The basketball players can't hide. The football linemen can't hide. They're mm-hmm. they're all pretty easy to spot. But they take it seriously, and that's really comforting.
Yeah. I don't tell my guys this, but in that McCosh 50 classroom, I tell them, make sure you're early because everyone knows when you're coming in late, and everyone knows who you are. You know, Kevin, the faculty fellow program, when I was in school, there was a guy named Marvin Bressler, and he was very close with Julian Zelizer's mom. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just he was the faculty fellow, right? There was really like one guy. Right. He was with men's basketball. You're a faculty fellow for us, and we're very thankful for that. So really, I just want to say thank you for—
No, thanks for having me.
Being yourself— chatting with us today and giving us some sort of perspective on, you know, I could, from a personal perspective, I could sit here and listen to you all day. I wish I could go to your class every single day, but I really appreciate you taking some time with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for all the good work you do, too.
Thanks.
Awesome.